Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra. As always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Andrew. How are you doing? You're back in Dublin.
I'm back in Dublin. You're back in London. Not even airports can keep us from our mission, our job to talk about football and talk about Arsenal.
We flew back for the podcast.
That's exactly it. Even though we were already scheduled to do it, we did it with vigor and with energy and with tiredness, I would say.
Arguably, we could have convened in the UK, seeing as you were in London and I was heading to London, but we stuck with tradition.
That's true. We could have crossed paths at like Heathrow Airport.
Recorded it live from the, exactly, arrivals at Heathrow.
Do they have, I mean, everywhere has a podcast studio these days. They must have one now at Heathrow Airport. Terminal 2, it's new and fancy. This is the next thing they need to get in there, along with, like, you know, they've got the Yo Sushi, they've got the Pret-a-Manger, they've got the Sunglasses Hut. Now they just need a podcast studio. We're not sponsored by any of those people, by the way. I just want to make that clear.
Have they got a Costa Coffee? Because I am in bed with Costa Coffee. Famously,
that's true. So. Yeah, big Costa, big coffee, you and your big coffee.
How was your trip?
My trip was good. It was actually, it was great to be in the stadium last night and to sort of experience the atmosphere that people have been talking about. I haven't been there since we played Sheffield United earlier in the season, the 5-0, the Eddie Nketiah hat-trick. And, you know, with all due respect to Eddie and Sheffield United and that game and that occasion, it's not quite a Champions League quarter-final. It was illuminating, I have to say, because, you know, I don't go every week like you. You go every week or every second week or whenever we play at home. But I've been to many matches at the Emirates, and I don't think I've ever heard it as loud as I heard it last night.
Oh, really?
It was genuinely, not deafening, but like, oh, this is so loud. And the whole stadium singing and, you know, getting behind the team. And it was fantastic, a fantastic experience. You know, the game could have been a bit better, and I'm sure we'll come to that. But as a trip to see people, have a few beers, go to the game, and just experience that and sort of that sense of, I think there's a sense of potential in that kind of support as well. You know what I mean? It's all baked in there. So it was great. How was, before we get on to the game, how was your trip?
Yes, it was good. Thanks, man. It was good. I found the right pub eventually, which was great. So, yeah, I watched. I'm trying to remember what the pub's called now. I've forgotten.
The Misconduct Tavern. Is that not it?
That's it. I was in my head. I was like, it's the Misadventure Arms or something like that. But, yeah, the Misconduct Tavern. I found the correct branch and watched it with the guys from Arsenal Philly, who are incredibly hospitable and welcoming and kind. And there was a ton of them there. Bear in mind, this game took place during working hours.
Yeah.
I was very impressed with both the turnout and the quantities of alcohol being consumed during the daytime.
I'm working from home today, boss.
Yeah, pretty much. So, yeah, that was great. So thanks so much to those guys for hosting me. And, yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I'm hopefully, with any luck, I'll be back there in the summer.
Ooh, okay. We can talk about that a little bit down the line, obviously, but we have a very big game, a very important game, and a very interesting game to talk about right now, I think. And in the cold light of day, having been able to rewatch certain aspects of it and certain elements of it, there's really quite a lot to unpack from this one. And just before we get into the details, into the nuts and bolts of it, you know, 2-2 draw in a Champions League quarterfinal against Bayern Munich, while the other quarterfinal played out a 3-3 draw between Manchester City and Real Madrid. You know, is, for all the things that we might have done better and all the things that we didn't do as well as we can, is there not just some, a sort of energy at this point in this competition which makes games like this and like the game between City and Real Madrid, it just sort of makes these mad games happen, if that's the right way to put it?
It seemed to last night, certainly. I mean, you know, that game in Madrid was crazy as well, and the goals just kept on coming. I do wonder if maybe it's to do with the elimination of the away goals rule, if that might reduce the jeopardy for teams, so maybe they're a bit more willing to go for it. You know, previously I remember times where we were in a two-legged tie with the away goals in play, and after the home game, you know, or for the home game, you'd be saying, well, 0-0's not a bad result.
Yeah,
no, 0-0's not a bad result. Whereas here, there isn't that fear of, well, if we concede an away goal, we've got this huge mountain to climb. So I wonder if that plays into it, but certainly it was a firecracker of a game and two brilliant matches, actually. I, like a lot of Arsenal fans, would have been very keen to watch that Man City-Madrid game. So I was a little bit gutted that they were scheduled to be alongside each other. Yeah. And it does seem odd, you know, to put the two English teams in the competition on the same night. But there you go.
There you go. That is the vagaries of the draw and nothing we can do about that. So
quick question, Andrew. Yes. You spoke about the atmosphere. What was it like being in a ground with no away fans? Because I'm trying to think, I don't think that's an experience I've ever had.
No, it was quite unique in that sense. And there was actually a question here on our Discord from Mikkel's Hairspray. He doesn't need hairspray. He doesn't. It just naturally, it's like that. Anyway, he said, would you say the atmosphere at the Emirates last night was improved or hindered by the lack of away fans?
Mm.
Like, I don't think it was improved. How do I put this? Like, I think there might have been a bit more noise because there were another 3,000 Arsenal fans in there, in that section where the away fans would be. And it was spectacular. It genuinely was. When the Saka goal went in, it was incredible. People were limbs everywhere, et cetera, et cetera, right? And it was noisy. But I do wonder if, after Bayern got their goals, which really did suck a lot of the energy out of the stadium, it was almost like people were sort of sitting on their hands a bit, which I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying that's my experience from what was happening around me, that people were, you know, deflated and downhearted because it was so exciting and enthralling. And then we give them those two goals and people are like, ugh. I do wonder if, in response to some crowing from the away fans, if the Arsenal fans would have responded just a little bit differently, you know, a bit more quickly, for example.
Yeah, well, they sort of feed each other.
Yeah, exactly. There's that symbiotic relationship. You know, they're all happy and, you know, you want to get your team going again. And the absence of the away fans, like, I would prefer if there were some away fans there, I have to say.
Yeah, and that, what, the 200 Bayern dignitaries in attendance didn't sort of unify in chanting or anything like that?
I did see down below me, actually, there was a section in the below me where maybe some Bayern fans who got tickets made themselves known at one point, and then, from what I understand, they were unceremoniously turfed out on their ear, having been given pelters physically and maybe a little bit more by some of the Arsenal fans around them. But, you know, whoever sold them those tickets, I don't think is going to be in good shape with the club, because they were quite strict about that, weren't they?
Of course. Yeah.
So there were a few, obviously, who snuck in, and, you know, I think the majority of them were sensible enough to kind of sit there and just not make themselves known. But, you know, there's always one or two the other way around.
Interesting. Okay, so what about the starting lineup? Any surprises for you?
Kivior.
Yeah, there's a big surprise for me, having on Monday basically said, yeah, I think we've probably, Kivior's had his run in the team now. I don't expect to see him for a little while.
That was a surprise to me. I did think Martinelli would come back in. I did think Saka would start.
Yeah.
I thought it would probably be Tomiyasu at left back in this game. So I suppose what we could maybe deduce from this is that Mikel Arteta doesn't think, or the information that he has available to him is that Tomiyasu isn't fit enough to start a game like this.
Maybe, you know? So.
So that, I mean, that would be my explanation. And it's not, again, to sort of do Kivior down. But ultimately, when everyone is fit, that classic line, when everyone is fit, he is basically the fourth choice left back. So it was a little bit of a surprise to me that we went with our fourth choice left back in a Champions League quarterfinal. Perhaps it was Arteta saying, you know what, we've been on a great run. Kivior was part of that great run. You know, he can do a job. He can do the job I need him to do. And I don't even think really that Kivior was terrible or anything like that. But it was a surprise to me. And I do wonder if Kivior and Martinelli, neither of them played particularly well. And I think I was looking for a bit more from Martinelli. And I did wonder if there was a, you know, a connection between Kivior starting and Martinelli not quite being in the game as much as you would like him to be.
Yeah, possibly. Possibly. I mean, you know, I felt like Kivior struggled a little bit at Manchester City, and this was another big game against another big, like, very difficult opponent in Leroy Sané, right? I mean, and for someone who's playing out of position, I just thought it was a really big ask. And I'm sorry to say, I wasn't especially surprised when he was hooked, essentially, at half-time.
No, I mean, that was pretty much everybody was talking about that substitution being in the pipeline at halftime. Everyone around me was saying, well, we've got to get Kivior off and we'll put Tomiyasu on at halftime. As it was Zinchenko, and we'll talk about him maybe when we come to that. But yeah, I think everybody could see that was a change that absolutely needed to be made. Towards the end of the half, maybe it's just my eyes, maybe the stats don't bear this out, but I felt at times like Kivior wasn't necessarily being bypassed, but we were going back the other way. We weren't really using him. The passes weren't going to him in a way that they might ordinarily go, you know? And I wonder if that played into the manager's decision as well. You know, sometimes you can tell a lot from the way the other players react to another player's performance.
Yes, I think there may be something to that. You know, we were going at their left flank more anyway. We had a kind of right-sided bias in the way we played. And I think especially once Davis picked up a yellow card, I think, you know, that's where we looked to get at them and hurt them. But, you know, Kivior wasn't particularly influential on the ball and seemed to be struggling to keep up with Sané off the ball. That's not to kill him. I mean, a lot of defenders would struggle to live with Sané, right? He's electric, and he really was for Bayern last night.
Yeah, maybe we'll come to the moments, because we'll talk about their goals, and I do think Kivior was for the second one. There's, you know, Sané is a very good player, but I think there are things that he could have done in that situation. However, the game started very well from an Arsenal perspective, and we went ahead, what was it, 12, 13, 15 minutes? I can't quite remember the time.
12 minutes, I think, yeah.
Kai Havertz did well to win the ball back. Ben White played it to Bukayo Saka, and Saka, I think this is a really, really good finish from Saka, because sometimes you see a player, the ball breaks to him in the box, he has a pop, he knows where he is more or less, but I think when you look at the replays of this, you can see Saka take a touch, have a look, and just put the ball exactly where it needs to go to get beyond Manuel Neuer. I think it's a great finish from Saka.
It is a brilliant take. Do you know what? I don't know if he does take a touch, Andrew, before.
Does he not?
I think he just spins on it, which, if I'm right, I think is actually one of the really impressive things about it. I mean, because it's a pass like into his path, and he's able to just completely adjust his footwork and his body to be able to sweep it in first time, I think. It's a beautiful goal, really beautiful goal. And yeah, I bet the atmosphere was crazy at that point.
Yeah, hang on, I'm going to have a look. Oh, you're right. He lets the ball run across him, actually. I thought he'd taken a tiny touch, but no, the ball just runs runs across him, has a look, gets it. I mean, it's a great finish. It really is. And the atmosphere was amazing. And then there was a chance to make it 2-0.
Yeah, big moment, I would say.
Big moment. It's not often, though, that you would see your right back in that position, though, you know, in a game like this. Like, I think I do think Ben White has got the technical ability and the sort of composure character to have done a bit better there. Mm-hmm. Like, a bit more precision. I think he just rushed it a little bit. He didn't quite pick his spot. Just sort of hit it and hit it straight at the goalkeeper. But I'm not going to kill a centre-half playing a right-back who's all of a sudden in a centre-forward position for not scoring to make that 2-0. But I do... It's impossible not to wonder what might have happened if that chance had been scored. If that had gone in, if Arsenal had been 2-0 up after 20 minutes, there or thereabouts, you know, obviously the dynamic is different. And I wonder if that was a sort of a crescendo that we could have ridden, if you know what I mean.
Arteta went quite big on it. You know, he said, you got to take that chance kind of thing. It's nice play by Havertz. He wins a second ball and, you know, finds Ben White. I would say Ben White has many, many, many attributes, but I've not considered one of them being finishing or goal scoring necessarily. You know, he doesn't seem to have that kind of Gabriel Koscielny knack of, you know, finishing things off inside the opponent's penalty box. But yeah, I don't know. He must just kind of hesitate a little bit and ends up going pretty much straight at the keeper.
I think it's one of those where because you're not used to being in that position, you think, okay, I'm going to just hit this as hard as I can and hope that it goes either side of the goalkeeper or through his legs. But
I've been there. But I think, I'm with you in that I think he's good enough to have scored there. And if we had, it just felt like we were going to sort of run away with it at that point in the game. And maybe that's not true. We'll never know, you know, sliding doors and all that. But given what followed, it was definitely a big moment in the game.
Yeah, it certainly was. So what followed were two relatively quick goals for Bayern Munich. Where do you stand on the first one in terms of blame? We're trying to analyze it, try to unpack it and see why it happens. So maybe blame is the wrong word, but what did we do wrong here and who did what wrong, I suppose, is the way I would put it. I was a bit surprised to see David Raya quite that far up the pitch and also making a move towards the ball where, you know, really he should have dropped back and maybe taken a pass from Gabriel in that situation. Gabriel turns, he's under a little bit of pressure from Harry Kane, I think it is. Plays a kind of a reverse pass towards Kivior. I know people have opinions about Kivior in this game. I don't necessarily think that's on him per se. I think it's just a misplaced pass, which catches him out. And from there, obviously Bayern take it forward. Declan Rice, you know, usually so good at reading the game. He takes a step towards the ball, which allows Goretzka to run past him. He can't get back. Ball to Gnabry. Gnabry gets there before Ben White. And I think the shot went between Raya's legs and in off his heel.
Yeah. I mean, where do I attribute blame? I think there's a few things, really. I mean, Raya's proactive coming off his line has been a real positive for us this season, but I think he does get this one wrong. I think he misreads the ball over the top, essentially. I think he thinks it's going to run through to him and doesn't quite. Gabriel gets there. And then what he wants, Gabriel, is a sort of 20-yard knocking the ball back to his keeper, but there's no one there.
Yeah.
So he can't do that. He tries to turn on it. With hindsight, he should probably just put it out for a throw-in, you know, but that's not the way that he's instructed to play. It's not the way Arsenal do things. He tries to keep the ball and miscues that pass. I'm with you. I don't think there's a great deal Kivior can do with that pass. It's pretty, if you look at the angle, there's an angle like behind the goal. It's pretty wide of him. Yeah. It's not a great ball from Gabriel.
I'm watching it again here.
And then Bayern pounce. And I was surprised to see Goretzka run off Rice like that. It's not often you see player sort of burst past Declan Rice in that fashion.
No, I think what Rice looks like he's trying to anticipate a pass into Goretzka, into feet.
Yeah.
But he, you know, that step he takes forward is fatal there because Goretzka can just run beyond him. The pass into him is good. The run from Gnabry in from the left-hand side is very good. The finish is good, you know.
Well, that's the thing about this game, and I think about this level in terms of being in a Champions League quarterfinal, is that if you do make mistakes, you probably will be punished because your opponents have a caliber of attacker that we don't come up against every single week.
I think that's exactly right. You know, that there was a lot of talk about Bayern, and maybe this is something we'll come on to a bit later on, but if they have some problems, if they have some weaknesses, it's not in the top end of the pitch where you've got Serge Gnabry and Leroy Sané and Musiala and Harry Kane. You know, it is not where they are weak. So to make a mistake and to be punished ruthlessly by it, you know, we've talked about learning experiences with this team. We've talked about learning experiences with this manager. I'm sure this isn't fucking big news to them or anything, that if you make a mistake against really good players, chances are you're going to get punished for it. But it is a little bit of a reminder that, you know, you have to be nigh on perfect to win games like this or to get the right results. And, you know, maybe there is a need next time that kind of situation arises, if it arises, for Gabriel to maybe just take the industrial option, if you know what I mean, and boot it out for a throw and just get reorganized and get reset. And you don't leave yourself open the way we left ourselves open there. I mean, look, the other thing is that pass could have hit Kivior and we could have started a move and put the ball down the right-hand side. And who knows? You know, we don't know. But I think there are times where you really do have to play the percentages. And that was one of those moments and we didn't.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? Because Arteta's teams have clear principles of play, and I don't think he's ever going to be too critical of a player for following those. But yeah, with hindsight, you'd like to see Gabriel take the easy option.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were a few moments like that, actually, where you have to consider the percentages in what you do. We had a really good, I think it was second half. It all gets a bit fuzzy, you know? But second half, there was a free kick not too far outside the box. And Martin Odegaard had the chance to curl it in into an area where we had four, five, six men maybe, right?
And he went for the little chip
pass. He went for the little chip pass over the top for Kai Havertz. Like, if that works, it's a piece of genius and a piece of brilliance. But in games like this, when you're a team like Arsenal who can score goals from set pieces, play the percentages as well as you can. If you're in a situation in the last 20 minutes of a two-legged tie where you have to be more risk-taking, or you have to try and find that opening, the thing that somebody expects, fine. I do think in the first leg of a game at home, you just need to be a bit more solid. And there were too many occasions. We did it in the second half with some of our passing. I get that, you know, Zinchenko tries to make things happen. But there were a couple of moments where I think he could have just kept the ball moving and kept the ball circulating. And he went for a pass that wasn't really on. And it ends up being a goal kick for Bayern Munich. And they have to, you know, reset and try and win the ball back again. There was just a bit too much of that in the Arsenal performance yesterday. I don't know if that's down to lack of experience or you know, players trying to do things individually to raise the overall level. But, you know, this wasn't a game that we absolutely 100% had to win last night. You know, it was the first leg of a two-legged tie. So I think there's something there for the manager to take and something there for him to talk to his players about. You know, as we progress and develop as a team and hopefully have many more of these kinds of ties going forward.
Yeah, it's a bit of COD psychology, really, on my part. So, you know, I wouldn't take this too seriously. But I did feel a bit like we were chasing the game too early. You know, almost as if maybe the fact that there were no away fans you know, and we'd get the club had given it the big build up about what an important night this was. And I don't know, I just had this slight sense watching it that it felt like we wanted to win it on the night, you know, that I think we played a bit like we could beat them 2 or 3, you know, and put ourselves in a really comfortable position. And I think that's partially what left us quite vulnerable and exposed to quite simple counterattacks in some ways from Bayern.
Yes.
I think we overcommitted a little bit at what was, you know, a very early stage of a two-legged tie.
For sure. And I think that was evident in the second goal as well, where we weren't precise enough at the top end of the pitch. But by committing so many men forward, we left ourselves open to a counterattack by just a simple ball up the line. This is where I have a slight issue with Kiwior's performance, right? Because I was looking at the stats. He was dribbled past once in this game. Zinchenko came on, was dribbled past, I think it was twice or three times in this game. But this particular one, just inside the Bayern half, I think he's got to be more cynical. We've talked a lot about players needing to be cynical and needing to be cynical at this level. And if you go for the ball, you don't get it. Fine. If you understand that in not getting the ball, you've left yourself vulnerable to the opponent spinning you, you take a fucking handful of shirt or whatever it is, and you stop him running and you take a yellow card and you manage yourself through the game. But that is what you have to do at this level. Like, I think any player and many defenders, when they play against Leroy Sané or somebody of that quality, will find themselves in a duel like that on the wrong end of it because he's so good and he's so quick. But it's how you react to that, and it's how you deal with that in that split second. It just was a bit weak from Kiwior. He had to take the free kick there and had to take the yellow card.
Yeah, I mean, there's getting beat and there's getting beat, isn't there? And he got absolutely roasted on this one. It's not pretty viewing at all. And to be fair, we couldn't get to Sané, could we? We couldn't stop him. I think three players lunge in trying to halt him. I think maybe it's Jorginho, then Gabriel, and then eventually Saliba brings him down. It's a blistering run. But yeah, listen, if Kiwior can bring him down, make the foul right at the start and stop it, so be it. And like you say, manage him through the game, or we've got two left backs on the bench potentially.
Yes, so exactly.
It's not something we have to be worried about. But you know, that's why I think it was always a bit of a curious matchup. You know, I wouldn't look at Sané and Kiwior and think, you know, that looks like trouble to me from kickoff.
Sure. Yeah, I agree. I agree. With all due respect to Kiwior and how well he's done, it worried me at the start, and it worried me in the game. I mean, the run is good. Jorginho lunged in. I mean, he just runs in a diagonal as well. He is quick, and he is obviously in full control of the ball, but Jorginho goes in. Gabriel kind of pulls out of a challenge, and I think Saliba's slightly not caught on his heels. I think he's expecting Gabriel to go in and then reacts to Gabriel not going in. And it's 100% a penalty. Before we get to the penalty, though, can I just sort of widen this out? And I know we've talked about this a little bit, but I thought at the end of last night's game that this game was proof positive to me anyway, that despite all the options we have at left back, Arsenal need a left back. Arsenal need their left-sided Ben White. And I know everyone's going to be screaming Jurrien Timber's name right now. And if it's him, great. I'm not necessarily convinced that that's what he's going to be for Arsenal. I don't mean he can't play there and won't play there. I just really think that if you can't start Tomiyasu in this game, and if you can't or won't start Zinchenko in this game, and you do start your fourth choice center back in this game, or fourth choice left back in this game, it says to me that the squad isn't quite where it needs to be in a very, very important position. Yeah. And I do think this is something for them to think about in the summer.
Well, you know what's mad is that obviously Kieran Tierney is still on the books as well. So we've actually got five potential left backs within the squad, six if you count Nuno Tavares. And yet we don't really know who the first choice is. And maybe that's a bit of a problem, right? Like if there's all these candidates, but none are absolutely convincing. Maybe it is something that needs addressing. I would be inclined to agree. I think left back, I think it will be on the agenda this summer. And I think it ought to be. Maybe Timber can be that guy. Maybe he can. But, you know, I think they've got other plans for Timber as well. I think they want to use him at right back. And, you know, I don't think we should discount him playing at centre half either.
No, I mean, look at Ben White, who's amazing and, you know, everyone loves Ben White, but Ben White has been playing with a heavily, heavily, heavily strapped knee for about 3 weeks now.
Yeah.
He, you know,
And carrying an issue with that knee for longer than that.
And he is, you know, he is suffering the consequences of our reliance on him. And I really do think that part of why we bought Timber was to ease that burden on him. And again, look, he can play left back and he might well play left back. I just don't really think that there are too many teams, top teams, who are playing a right-footed player at left-back for the whole season. You know, I just don't think that really happens. I could be wrong. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong. But I think a right side of Timber and White and a left side of who, I don't quite know. But I think it's an issue for the club. I think it's an issue for this team because there's not any real certainty about this position, and it's a very important position, as we saw last night. Harry Kane scored the penalty, which, you know,
is a certain degree of inevitability.
Sure as night follows day. Where was this? I enjoyed this on the Discord from Big Harrow 99. Not a question, but more of a hint for those struggling with the high cost of living. I put my entire life savings on Harry Kane to score a penalty against Arsenal. Risky, I know. Seriously, though, he gets one every time. Anyway, good news. I'm $87 richer today. So congratulations to you, Big Harrow.
I mean, David Raya went quite early. I thought it was almost like he wanted to just get it over with as well. He's going to score. Put it in the net, Harry. Let's all get on with our lives.
It's it was an unusual kind of penalty from Kane. You don't see him take those very often. Like, quite often the precision is there, but it's usually coupled with a lot of power.
Yeah.
I think he said, I think I read some quotes somewhere earlier today about how, you know, he saw Raya move and it was relatively easy for him to just put it where he thought he was going to put it anyway. So that's 2-1. And like I said, the stadium is a little bit deflated, discouraged and disappointed and frustrated, of course, because of the nature of the goals that we conceded. I think if you concede two brilliant goals to a team like Bayern Munich, you go, okay, all right. But when you're masters of your own downfall, particularly in a period where I think Arsenal, I don't think you can say we've been flawless, because that doesn't really exist in football, but I think we have, you know, cut a lot of silly stuff and errors out of our football, and for two big errors, relatively big errors, to manifest themselves on the big European stage, on a big important night, I think it really, it was really unfortunate to see it, and it did take the wind out of our sails for sure.
Well, it could have been worse, couldn't it? I mean, we spoke about Ben White's miss at one end of the pitch, but he pretty much prevented a goal at the other, didn't he? Chasing back to make that tackle.
Brilliant defending. When you look at it again, you know, the reading of Sané's run and the timing of his intervention is just superb. Brilliant defending. Because I think that would have been 3-1. And that would have been big, big trouble. Big trouble.
It's his header that gets cut out. So he's actually chasing back to atone in some respects for that. And nothing motivates you like a mistake on a football pitch.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
The speed he shows and the technique on that tackle is very impressive.
Right. So we're only at half time.
Yeah.
Kivior came off. Zinchenko came on.
Bit of a surprise again, maybe?
A little bit. Like, I did think it would be Tomiyasu. I genuinely did. But I suppose at 2-1 down, it's not a huge surprise that somebody like Zinchenko comes on, you know, to give you maybe something a little bit more in possession, right? I'm curious as to what your read of Zinchenko's performance was, because in the stadium, he made me nervous. He made me nervous. And I wasn't alone in that. Quite a lot of the people around me were also quite nervous.
In possession or out of possession?
Both. Both. Right. No, genuinely. Like, you could... There was one ball over the top where, you know, that diagonal over his head that we've talked about quite a lot, Bayern were given offside and he kind of got away with one. But, you know, on the plus side, he held his line. Defensively, people were worried. I was certainly worried. The sort of, again, going back to the risk-reward element of someone like Zinchenko, a topic we've covered quite a bit. What made me more nervous wasn't what Zinchenko did or didn't do defensively, because I've come to peace with that, if you know what I mean. I know what he can do and what he can't do defensively. There are things he can do quite well, there are things he can't do quite well, and I think there's a relative consistency to those things. I thought in this game, in possession, I was worried and a little bit disappointed with the quality of his passing at certain moments. And if what he's supposed to be really strong at isn't as strong as it used to be, again, I think that comes back to what we've just been talking about with our left-back problem. Like, I don't think he was awful by any means, but I have to say I just felt worried about him, and maybe that's my issue. So I'm curious as to what you thought, because I know that when I did the player ratings last night, albeit without having watched a lot of it back, a lot of people disagreed with my rating of Zinchenko and my take on Zinchenko. So I'm curious as to what you thought.
Well, it is tricky because there is a bit of baggage around the player now, I think. You know, he is someone who generates a bit of anxiety. I'm not even saying that's unreasonable, but... I feel like, you know, every time he's picked, sort of certainly online, for example, the conversation is about, oh, is this going to cost us? I thought he was mixed in his game yesterday. I thought there were times where he forced it. You know, there were a few balls over the top that just ran out of play. I think he was looking to find Martinelli early and didn't always come off. What I thought he did well, or the respect in which he helped us, was that I think he helped us numerically in the middle of the pitch, where I think we'd struggled. You know, Jorginho and Rice have been really strong over the last couple of months, but I thought they found it quite hard going against Bayern. I thought Goretzka was quite dominant in there. And I think Zinchenko just gave us a bit more steadiness in terms of sort of the structure of the team. You know, he added an extra midfield body, essentially. Which I do think served us quite well, but equally it wasn't a Zinchenko game where I felt like he was the conductor, you know, driving us forward and pushing everything on. So I felt there was good and bad to his game. I thought on balance, I mean, Arteta essentially took the risk, didn't he, of bringing him on because we needed a goal. And I suppose on balance, he'll feel that it worked. But again, it comes back to what you were saying before. Is there a bigger conversation to be had about left back and the type of left back this squad may need moving forward?
Yeah. Some of the sort of pushback I got on the Zinchenko stuff was people saying that they thought Zinchenko completely changed the game, which I'm going to credit to two of the other substitutes. I think Gabriel Jesus and Leandro Trossard gave us things in this game that we hadn't had. Mm-hmm. Before we get to that, though, Harry Kane, red card or not for you?
I think that very easily could have been a red card. I think he's quite lucky that it wasn't. You've seen them giving us yellows. You've seen them giving us reds. I think, I mean, I'll use that kind of language probably on several decisions in this game, you know, that you've seen but go both ways. But I think on another night, he very may well have been sent off for that.
I think he should have been sent off. I think it's entirely deliberate. You know,
the look doesn't look good.
Exactly. Well, the look is so he knows where to swing his arm in order to connect with Gabriel. And I think that is what makes it a red card for me. Look, Kane is very strong. It was tough going, I think, for Gabriel at times against him because he is so strong and he's so canny and uses his strength very well a lot of the time. But as we know from experience, I think there are times where perhaps in the Premier League, with the protection of being England captain and all the rest, he has been able to get away with certain things that other players would not have been able to get away with. Mm-hmm. So we know that there is that side to his game. I think this particular incident, you can see him have a look. He throws an elbow back. He catches Gabriel on the underside of the chin / the throat. That is deliberate violent conduct, and it should have been a red card. Should have been a red card. I think he's very, very lucky.
I think that's right. I think he absolutely knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And him and Gabriel have had a lot of running battles down the years.
Yeah.
And it would have been a big moment for him to go off, A, because it would have been absolutely hysterical in front of 60,000 Arsenal fans, highlight of the season. But it would have also shorn them of him for the next game. Again, I take no pleasure in saying this, but I thought he put in a really good centre-forward performance. And that attacking formula Bayern have of Kane dropping in at, you know, three runners who can all sprint beyond him, it's quite effective, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Let's move on then to another controversial incident where Bayern Munich feel like they should have had a penalty.
Yeah.
This is confusing. I've watched this back quite a few times. Substitutions are being made. Gabriel Jesus and Leandro Trossard are coming on for Martinelli and Jorginho. The ref's whistle goes. Raya kicks it to Gabriel. Gabriel picks it up. The ref's whistle goes again. The Bayern player, we couldn't figure out. I didn't really understand what was happening in the stadium at the time because I don't know whether I just wasn't paying attention.
That's just by completely on TV. I'm not even sure the US commentary, you know, drew attention to it.
Yeah, because we were looking at Kane going, what the fuck are you complaining about? The ball's in play. What play the fucking game.
We thought he was complaining because, you know, Kane had a shot, right? I think that deflected off Rice. Was it to do with that? I can't remember.
Can't remember exactly.
We thought maybe they were claiming for a handball on the block because we just couldn't make sense of it because it's obviously a really strange incident. And this thing of defenders taking goal kicks is quite recent. Mm. So there's not much precedent for something like this.
No, there isn't. Bayern obviously are very unhappy about it and remain very unhappy about it today. And Thomas Tuchel was unhappy about it. I saw some quotes from their sporting director talking about how unhappy they were about it. I mean, how do you... I'm trying to, you know, think about this and think about what would happen if it was up the other end.
Sure.
And,
yeah,
and
that is the way to think about it.
And I'm sort of... Like, if they gave a penalty, I obviously wouldn't complain about it. I'd say that was a bit odd. But at the same time, I don't think I could bring it, or I could bring myself to vociferously complain that a penalty wasn't given for that. Does that make sense? Like, if it had been fucking De Ligt and Neuer, or even, God forbid, Eric Dier. You know, if that had happened, like it would feel so churlish to demand a penalty because it's really just a silly little mix up. And I know technically it is a penalty. If the whistle is gone and Raya's played the ball and Gabriel picks it up, it's a handball in the box, technically. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, I wouldn't complain if we got that up the other end, but I would not feel any real sense of injustice if the referee did, you know, what he did in this game and just sort of said, look, play on. That's just, come on.
The point I've heard made elsewhere is what advantage did we gain from it? You know? And the answer is none. I mean, it's sort of a technicality. Gabriel obviously doesn't realise that the kick has been taken. So, yes, the referee could have blown for a penalty. Personally, I like that he didn't, A, because I'm an Arsenal fan and I don't want it to be given, but B, because, you know, I often say I want common sense applied. And I think common sense dictates that, you know, an 80% chance of a goal in the form of a penalty kick would be unjust punishment for something a sort of...
Yeah.
You know, that has no malice whatsoever attached to it and which gains no advantage. You'd be being a real job's worth to apply that particular law at that particular time. Mm,
I'd be interested to know or interested to have seen how big Bayern's complaints about this incident would have been if the score had stayed 2-1, for example. Like, if they'd won the game.
Well, you know. Yeah, maybe. And another thing to consider, I think, is whether this decision or Bayern's complaints about this decision factored into the decision he made at the end of stoppage time.
I have a strong suspicion that it did.
Yeah, I think it's very plausible. Very plausible, right? We've all had experience of seeing referees do that, you know, to think, oh, I might have...
I was a bit generous for them, yeah. I'll
even things up or whatever. I've no doubt. I mean, it's just basic psychology, isn't it? That might be in play. Mm. I think it's a really weird one. If they'd given it, would we all be criticising Gabriel this morning and saying he lost head after the Kane thing?
Maybe.
I don't know.
I think we'd just say that was like a complete... just a brain fart for a couple of seconds. Yeah. It was just a complete mix-up. I think we would probably be saying it's absolutely outrageous or absurd to give a penalty in a Champions League quarterfinal for something like that. And I think that would be true at both ends.
Would have been a bit like sending Robin van Persie off for putting that ball in the back of the net in the Nou Camp.
Exactly. You know? Yeah, it would be exactly in that ballpark.
It's like, okay, technically... you could do it, but...
you shouldn't.
It's sort of... you shouldn't because, you know, you're doing more damage to a game and the offence was so, you know, without malice. Mm.
The lesson here, of course, for Bayern Munich is to do what Barcelona did and pay the referees first.
Allegedly. So anyway, depending on how you interpret that, we either get away with it or we don't. And Trossard gets us an equaliser.
Great work from Gabriel Jesus, who I thought gave the attack a bit of drive, a bit of impetus, a bit of oomph. And you know, it has emerged today. I mean, look, I think we were talking about this a bit, over the last week or so about Gabriel Jesus's knee, where there was sort of information that people were kind of sitting on about the condition of his knee, which is not good. And he's come out today. It has emerged today that he may well need surgery on this. Jesus says about the Copa America, I don't know if my knee will be good enough to be available. This is in the summer. He said, it doesn't matter if at the end of the season I have to open up my knee and correct what's getting in the way and missing out on the chance to play for the Copa America. He said, my desire is always to be available for both Arsenal and the national team. But I think where we are now with him is a situation where, you know, I suspect probably he's been playing through a bit of pain or a bit of... there's been a problem that he's been playing through in order to, you know, play in a World Cup or play for Arsenal and play for Brazil. And I think now he's sort of prioritizing the fitness aspect of this. And, you know, there was team selection talk and team selection decisions about next week and who starts and who doesn't and everything else. But it's clear from what Jesus has said and what, you know, we understand and information that we've had that he is very much being nursed through the final part of this season.
Yeah, absolutely. And it may affect how frequently he can play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they probably have to manage his minutes quite carefully to keep him available for selection. But he had a big impact in this game. I was a little bit surprised, I have to say, at how Arteta reshuffled it. You know, seeing Jesus back through the middle, we've not really seen that for a few games. He's been out on the left. Havertz dropping a bit deeper. Trossard on the flank. But it worked well, and Jesus's unpredictability, I think, gave us a new dimension in attack. And his assist for Trossard is really a thing of beauty. I mean, the close control and then the awareness to release it at the right time. And there's no one in the squad I'd rather have coming onto it than Leo Trossard. Yeah. I mean, the guy knows where the goal is.
Excuse me. He sure does. You know, it's a great finish, and what a big goal that could be in the context of this tie. We don't know. We don't know. But I fairness is not really a thing in football. But it would have been very frustrating because of, you know, what we did early on in that game and how we actually gave Bayern those two goals, not to have got something from this game. Was it someone, I can't remember which player said, yeah, we'll be happy with a point. It doesn't quite work like that in knockout ties, but it could have been Trossard himself, actually, I can't remember. But it's a big, big goal, and I think obviously it's important because it means we go into the second leg level. But I also think as a way of sort of demonstrating that there is something about this team, that, you know, even if we were poor on the night, and even if we did make bad decisions, and even if we gave goals away, we've got the quality and the character to get ourselves back into the game and to ensure that we go to Munich level. I think, you know, I think it's pretty even, Steven, going into the second leg. We can play better. Maybe Bayern can play better. But I think with, you know, with a goal deficit, I mean, it obviously makes it more difficult, but I just think there's something about what that goal means for, you know, the perception of this Arsenal team above and beyond the result last night.
Yeah, I think it's a massive goal. Another massive goal for Trossard in the Champions League. And, you know, my fear around that time in the game was that as we went looking for an equaliser, as we went chasing it, Bayern had already demonstrated their threat on the counter. Mm. And I felt that a 3-1 defeat at the Emirates Stadium was very much a possibility. And I think that would have been incredibly difficult to overturn in Germany. So I think in the context of the tie, it's a massive goal and a massive moment. I mean, in fairness, Bayern very, very nearly nicked it, didn't they, in stoppage time?
My recollection of that, I'd have to watch it back, and I haven't really. My recollection is that in the build up to that moment or before, that they were miles offside and they played on, but it could easily have been a passage of play that was like 2 or 3 minutes before that. Things get quite mixed up, you know, when you don't see replays of things and replays of play. You need to do
I'm watching back homework. Now that there is a moment where it looks like someone may be offside. I'm just trying to see if Zinchenko. Yeah, it does look like, I don't know who that is on the left wing for Bayern, I'm afraid. Maybe it's, I don't know. But the left winger, whoever it is at that particular point in time, looks like they are ahead of Zinchenko and potentially off. And then Koeman knocks it against the post. So I don't know if it would have stood.
No.
But it was a heart-in-mouth moment, that's for sure.
It certainly was. And then we have the the final drama right at the death where Bukayo Saka gets played in behind. Neuer hangs out a leg.
Mm-hmm.
Saka hangs out a leg.
Yeah.
The two collide. And, you know, this is a big talking point. You know, it's one of those where I think if it's given, nobody really argues too much with it. But I can sort of understand why it wasn't given at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a couple of penalties recently in the Premier League that I think are sort of worth mentioning in passing. I mean, one was obviously the Jesus one at Brighton, right? Where, you know, there was the discussion of, oh, player got the ball. But I thought that was absolutely nailed on a penalty. And then there was one at Old Trafford
yeah.
the following day which I think was closer to this one. Who was it? Harvey Elliott was brought down by Wan-Bissaka, right? And
there's no contact, by the way, between Harvey Elliott and Wan-Bissaka, like zero contact.
Yeah, I remember watching the Wan-Bissaka one on Sky, and I seem to remember Carragher and Neville sort of saying, yeah, it's a penalty. And I have to say, I was watching it and thinking, I'm not so sure. Like, I'd need to see that again because, you know, quite... it was Harvey Elliott sort of bought it in a big way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But a penalty was the decision. And therefore, I do find it difficult to look at this. I know it's different competition. I know it's different standards, different bar perhaps. But I do find it hard to see how this hasn't been given as a penalty, this one.
I think it's...
In sort of the full context of the game as it is today, you know?
Yeah, I think it is much more a penalty than not a penalty.
Same. I think it's more a penalty than the Harvey Elliott one.
Oh, I do think that. I mean, I don't think the Harvey Elliott one should be a penalty at all. I think it's really clumsy from Wan-Bissaka. But I think, you know, you need to... If you're going to give a penalty in a big game like that, the defender needs to make contact with the opposition player. I think in that situation, I know people say Saka should stay on his feet and go round him. Look, it's a split-second decision. There's a gigantic goalkeeper who comes out and hangs a gigantic leg out as you're trying to go beyond him. I think Bukayo Saka is well within his rights to make contact with Manuel Neuer. He doesn't have to get out of his way. There's nothing to say he has to get out of his way. And I think it's more a penalty than not a penalty, but I do understand why, after what happened earlier in the game, and the fact that, you know, there is an element of Saka, making contact with Neuer.
Yeah.
That probably informed the referee's decision. Like, Bukayo Saka definitely thought it was a penalty because he confronted the referee afterwards, and he even went on Instagram to do the, like, you know, I'm furious, you know, wind coming out of my nose emoji stuff. So, and he's not normally somebody who makes stuff like that public, and, you know, he's a guy who gets kicked to pieces every fucking week, you know?
So he is, and I heard he had a big old bump on his leg from this particular incident, you know. He took a whack. Listen, the more I look at it, the more I think it is a penalty. I think what's tricky about it is that there are certain angles that make it look more like a dive, and there are certain angles that make it look like a penalty. You know, I've seen a couple of stills or a couple of angles where Saka's leg looks to be in a really unnatural position. And I can understand why someone would look at that and say, well, no, we're not going to give a penalty for that. But then there are other angles where Neuer's leg seems to be dangling out. And you can absolutely call it a penalty from that perspective. So I think in one respect, sort of one of the lessons here is like... As much as we like to pretend that sort of objective truth is possible in officiating decisions in football, it probably isn't. Like, I think you're right to say it's more a penalty than it's not, but it's impossible to say definitively it is 100% a penalty or 100% not a penalty.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
I agree.
It's a grey area. But I wonder if, like you say, the previous decision he'd made with Arsenal and the Gabriel incident, I'm sorry to say, maybe the point in the game as well, and his knowledge that it was kind of the final seconds and this would have a huge swing effect on the tie potentially. I think, you know, the speed at which he made the decision and got off the pitch suggested to me that basically it's not a penalty he wanted to give, that's for sure.
Yeah. Maybe. You know, it's, you know, in real time, it was at the other end for me. But in real time, I was looking at it going, oh my God, that's got to be a penalty.
TV for me. Because where I keep coming back to is like, well, what is Neuer doing? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like one where a defender's chasing and he clips the back of someone's heel by accident. Neuer comes flying out, makes contact with the attacker and immediately puts his hands up. Do you know what I mean?
What do you think would have happened if that very same incident happened a yard outside the Bayern Munich box?
Yeah.
I think the referee
or
has...
Or at a different point in the game. Different point in the game.
Maybe, but I think if that happens a yard outside the box, the referee doesn't think twice about giving a free kick. Maybe it's... Yeah. Wrong for him not to treat a penalty incident in the same way as you treat a free kick? Should the bar be higher? Maybe your point about like what it might mean in the context of the game is potentially relevant here as well.
I'm not saying he was right to consider those things, but I'm just trying to explain my best theory as to why he may have made that decision.
Yeah.
I think it's a penalty. But at the same time, honestly, like of there have been various penalties over the years we've not gotten that have really rankled with me. There are others that I'll find this one slightly easier to stomach. And I think that might be because I kind of feel like it was sort of the right result on the night. And I would maybe even go a bit further and say, as much as I hoped and maybe even naively expected to win, I think at half time, if you'd offered me 2-2, I think I would have absolutely taken.
Yeah. I wonder, would we have got it if it had been 2-1? Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah,
Just...
It seems crazy that we're suggesting all these things, but it's human beings we're talking about, right? And that influences all sorts of decisions.
Yeah.
I do think in a VAR era, I really thought that would meet the bar. I have to say that one.
I'm a little bit surprised about that aspect of it as well. And I'm sort of...
Again, in real time, I was like, okay, I can sort of understand all the reasons referee might not give that in real time. Like, it's sensible in some respects. You're deciding the game in the final seconds. Let people who've got a proper look at it have a proper look at it.
Mm.
But it felt like quite a quick check. Certainly from where I was watching.
Yes. We've got a question about that actually. So we might do that in part two. And I think I'm slightly aligned with you. Like, I don't feel an absolutely massive sense of injustice about this particular incident. Would I have liked the penalty? Absolutely. I think it is, as I said, more of a penalty than not a penalty. But, you know, in the context of that overall performance from Arsenal, which had good and had bad, I'm just relatively calm and relatively pleased that we go into next week's game with the ability to sort of go into it on level terms. I think that was really, really important. Like, would Bayern's sense of injustice going into a second leg where we were 3-2 up, having gotten a penalty when they didn't get a penalty that technically they probably should have got, does that change the dynamic of the second leg? You know, we're talking ourselves around in circles and ifs and buts and maybes and all those things. But, you know, it's not one that I'm absolutely fuming about. There have been other... I'm much, much more unhappy about the Harry Kane decision, the yellow card, and not a red card than the Saka penalty.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's clearer.
Yeah.
I feel weirdly kind of at peace with this result in terms of, you know, we know exactly what we have to do. We go to Bayern, it's a one-off knockout game. Winner goes through. Let's have it.
Let's have it. All right, well, look, we've done over an hour on the game itself, which tells you a lot about what we saw last night and just how much was involved and maybe even the subjective nature of some of the things that were involved in that game. But it's 2-2 at halftime in this particular Champions League quarterfinal. Next leg, of course, next week. We had better take a little bit of a break here and we'll do some questions. We'll do a few questions when we come back in part two right after this.
Hey, Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you sent to us on Twitter, at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, also on the Arsblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arsblog member on Patreon. James, as you've got a transatlantic flight under your belt, you can go first.
Thank you. All right, well, I'll start with these. We've got a couple of questions about Declan Rice. So, Grimmer Soul said, hello, gents. Are we sure the Rice at number 8 formation is working in these big games? I hope Mikel knew they would try to catch us on the break, and not having Rice at 6 hurt us, in my opinion. And then AJ, on a similar theme, says, was this Rice's weakest performance for Arsenal? At the 8 in a game like this, he was far too far forward to limit Bayern's counters, but not aggressive enough in possession to influence the attack. Would you play him at 6 in Munich? Play Zinchenko to help him build up.
There's a lot to unpack there, isn't there? I think he did struggle a little bit, and I think he was not rendered ineffective, but there were times where his position on the pitch was not where I want to see Declan Rice in a big game. Mm-hmm. And that was quite a talking point around me in the stadium as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, would you mean sort of... camped on the edge of the box kind of thing in congested areas.
Yeah, he was a little bit too far out left maybe at times, a little bit too high up at times. I think I understand why he went with the team he did or with the midfield that he did, you know. But I do just do think Rice... You see, is he playing Rice there because he's our best eight available, or is he playing Rice there because Jorginho's experience is so important? Or is it a case that if you play Rice at 6, you've got a bigger, more difficult decision to make about who plays at left 8? You know,
yeah. Ideally, you'd have two Declan Rices, wouldn't you?
Yeah. There's only one Declan Rice, though, it seems.
Apparently.
Yeah,
that's what they
goes.
Say.
I think he did struggle a little bit in this game. I think our midfield didn't quite operate in the way that you would have liked it to in this game. And I would be more inclined to go with Rice at the 6 for the next game, but it really depends on what Mikel Arteta thinks he can get out of some of the other players that he has available to him, or whether he can make the 6 a bit more secure with somebody else in there. But, you know, I think Rice is our best deep-lying midfielder by a distance at this moment in time, so...
Yeah, I mean, again, a bit of hindsight here probably, but at halftime, I found myself thinking, you know, could we have done what we did in one of the Liverpool games and flipped Jorginho and Rice? Mm. And I presume we did that because we knew the likes of, you know, I forget who was playing up top for Liverpool that day, but whether it was Diaz or Salah or Nunez or Jota, you know, we knew the threat that they can offer on the break, and having Rice in a deeper position. Mm. You know, we spoke about that Sane run and Jorginho trying to get to him. I'd fancy Declan Rice to get to a Sane or a Gnabry over Jorginho.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so like, you know, maybe that would have been a wise move. But the problem is, you know, I read these suggestions and these questions and they say, would you play Rice at the six? And instinctively, I want to say yes. But then I find myself looking at the options then to play in midfield ahead of him. And I have to be honest and say I'm not convinced really by any of them at this particular point in time.
I'm with you on that. I think that, you know, if we talk about left back as a position for the summer, I think also central midfield is something that the club will certainly be considering. We did have a question like this from Freddie LJ. Says, afternoon. Thomas Partey is a poor sub as he doesn't seem to get to the rhythm of the game and his distribution becomes poor. Do you start him against Villa with a view to using him from the start in Munich, or what changes would you make for the second leg? But I think it's more interesting to discuss it in the context of Partey, you know, who did take a good yellow card. His experience kicked in and he took a yellow card to stop a break. But
he also had some sloppy moments, you know.
He did, and he wasn't alone in that, actually, in the final stages of the game. Ben White gave the ball away. There was Zinchenko again. Trossard let the ball run under his foot. Partey gave the ball away. I know he played the pass for Saka, but I'm not 100% convinced that's exactly the pass he was trying to make. I looked at him again in this game, and he just doesn't quite look at the level where I would feel confident starting him in any of the big games that we've got coming up, even Villa, while also acknowledging that there could well be a match fitness issue here that can only be solved by starting a guy. You know, it's a bit of a catch-22 in that sense.
It is. It's a really tricky one. You know, the question said he struggles to get up to pace with the game. I feel like at the moment he's struggling to get up to pace with the season. You know, it just sort of feels like it's passed him by, and we're in mid-April now. And is he going to get to match rhythm before the end of May? I'm not sure at this particular point in time.
This is why when people talk about Timber and Timber's return and won't it be brilliant, and it will be brilliant to have a really good player back in our team. Absolutely. Of course it will. But what do we realistically expect from Jurrien and Timber between now and the end of the season? What can we realistically expect, especially in the context of six or seven more games, or maybe two or three more, hopefully more in the Champions League, where the games are at such a high level and the stakes are so high that it almost feels unfair putting a guy who's been out for 9 months with, you know, probably the most serious injury that you can get in football, and ask him to play at the level and with the rhythm that these guys who've been doing it all season are capable of.
Yeah, and with the stakes being so high.
Yeah.
I think it, you know, feels less and less likely. I did at one stage have hope that, you know, we might see Timber in sort of true competitive action before the end of the season. I now think we might be in the territory of, you know, 20 minutes on the final day kind of thing. I just find it very difficult to foresee him being chucked in, as it were.
Mm.
As for Partey, you know, obviously he's a very talented player, and if I felt that we were able to select the best Thomas Partey of, you know, the first half of last season, then I think it's a no-brainer. I just don't necessarily think that's the Thomas Partey we've got right now.
No.
And what I'm seeing on the pitch isn't persuading me. You know, I do think he looks rusty and short of rhythm.
Mm.
And I just don't know if there's time for him to build it in what's left.
Yeah.
Which is frustrating because, you know, yeah, he would be a very, very handy player. Okay, what about this? The temperamental Gooners on Twitter says, did Trossard and Jesus show why they should be in the team ahead of Martinelli next week? Martinelli has the pace, which frightens teams, but Kimmich had him locked up, and it feels like a long time since Martinelli was making a difference for us.
Yeah, I had another question as well about Trossard from Bakary Lasagna on the Discord, who said, should Trossard start at left wing for us in the Champions League? Seems to have that extra level of maturity and composure that you need at this level of the competition. It would leave us with a great sub in Martinelli to bring off the bench. And there was another question about, it comes from, I think it's from Just W. Bennett, who asked a question about Trossard, like, is his impact from the bench such that leaving him on the bench is kind of a good idea, because if you need somebody to make an impact off the bench, he's proven that he can do it. It's a really tough one. I would probably be inclined to play Trossard from the start against Bayern next week away.
Really?
I think he's delivered, you know, goals with a kind of frequency and reliability this season that he's played his way into the first 11. I think if you're going to play Kivior and Martinelli as your left-hand side, I don't think that works. Zinchenko, Martinelli, even Tomiyasu and Martinelli is probably a little bit better. I mean, we have to remember Martinelli hasn't had a lot of minutes or rhythm in the last month or so. So if it's a game that you know is very likely to be tight, or at least the approach from Arsenal is likely to be pretty tight, Trossard is a guy who can get you not a goal out of nothing, but the ability to do what he does in tight areas. I don't think anybody else is really doing that. You know, I think he, along with Havertz, is probably our form attacking player at this moment in time.
And they have a nice understanding as well, those two.
They do, yeah.
It's always tempting to pick Martinelli because of what he offers you with the speed, you know, and breaking into space. If there's going to be space to run into, he is a real threat. And you look at what Bayern had last night, blistering pace from Sané and Musiala, Gnabry, all really strong, effective runners. And we could do with another one or two like that in our squad. And that's not what Trossard is. But equally, I take your point. I mean, he is very productive. And part of me wonders, if we took all the names and the reputations and the transfer fees and everything away from the players, you know, if we were judging them purely on their output, we'd probably be picking him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think because he came from Brighton and he was a second choice signing and we see him as a squad player, maybe we kind of categorize him in that way. But every time he gets a chance, you know, if you're Leo Trossard and you're not in that team, you've got the right at this point in time to be having one of those knocks on the manager's door. You know, he's doing pretty much everything that could be asked of him.
I agree. And look, it's not to say that every time Trossard plays, he does brilliantly. You know, been games he started that have passed him by, or games where he hasn't been able to make an impact. But I'm just looking, you know, at goal scoring. We're going to need some goals in Munich. And, you know, this season, he's our second highest goal scorer, isn't he? You know, he's got 13 goals. Bukayo Saka, 18 goals, and then you've Havertz and Odegaard on 10 each in all competitions. Martinelli on 8, Jesus on 8. You know,
and Saka's taking penalties, let's not forget. So,
yeah,
you know, Trossard's goal contribution from open play is very, very good. I think he's got a really strong case. And you know, Martinelli's an interesting sub as well, I think. particularly if you've got a game that, let's not forget, could be a 120-minute game.
Yeah, this is very true. This is very true. I think I would start Martinelli against Villa and an earmark Trossard for the start against Bayern, but we'll have to wait and see. You know, team selection for Bayern could be very heavily influenced by what happens against Aston Villa as well. So we have to remember that, and of course keep our focus on the Villa game on Sunday. Let me ask you this one from James Morgan, who's at Mullet Rider on Twitter. He says, has this Champions League run come too early in the hashtag project? We're in with a shot of the Champions League and Premier League double before the Arteta project has really matured. Lessons need to be learned regarding Champions League knockouts. It would almost feel odd winning it while learning on the job.
I know exactly what they mean with that question, actually. Like, do I really in my heart believe that we're ready to win the Champions League? No. I think we could do it. And I guess if we do it, we will have been ready. But with the Premier League, I have that sense of like, we went close, we learnt from it, we're in the mix again, we've taken those lessons on board. With the Champions League, it all feels quite new and fresh to this group. And it is entirely new and fresh to this group, the most of them. You know, playing in the Champions League knockouts, who's done it, right? Jorginho, Havertz. I seem to remember thinking there was one other player in the squad who's got that sort of experience, maybe Thomas Partey. But there's not a great deal of it. Zinchenko and Jesus, I guess, you know, you'd say as well with City. But the rest of the squad, it's new to them. So I think Arteta's Arsenal generally have always kind of operated a year ahead of schedule. You know, I think we were close to nicking the top four probably before we were ready for it, and then close to winning the league probably before we were ready for it. And now we're on the cusp potentially of a Champions League semi-final. And maybe it is a little bit early. Maybe it is a bit premature. But these are the experiences from which you learn and which put you in a place to be able to go on and win it. I mean, look at Man City. Look how long it took Man City to win the Champions League with all the resource, with all Guardiola's experience. I think it is its own beast to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And listen, I don't rule out that we could do it. We absolutely can. But I think if we do, we'll be ahead of schedule.
Yeah, I think that there's no arguing with that, that we would be ahead of schedule. I just think a Champions League run is educational. Certain players and maybe even the team itself have to understand and realize that Champions League football is a bit different from Premier League football.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of people talking about Saliba. You know, is he as good in Europe as he is in the Premier League? Maybe not, but he'll learn. This team will learn. And I think, you know, as we've often talked about, there is an ability from this manager and this group of players to very quickly learn from situations that haven't gone as well as possible, mistakes that they made, performances that have been below par, tactical decisions that haven't been quite right. You know, we're never going to win the Champions League with this group of players unless we go through some of these experiences, learn from them, and improve.
Yeah.
We talked about the first leg against Porto and about how their experience as a club of the Champions League was so important to them and how it made life difficult for us. Like, this is a Bayern team that 4 years ago won the Champions League with most of these players. You know, so you can't underestimate just understanding the way the opposition are different, the way the referees are different, the way the occasions are different, you know, all of those things. As we said in part one, you know, it's a two-legged tie, and maybe we went a bit too quickly in the first leg. Like, learn from it. You know, it's not a fatal mistake at this point, but learn from it. And I think it's absolutely crucial to the development of this team, whether we get past Bayern or not, that we have been here at least to this stage of the competition because we want to go further.
Yeah. And I think as fans and maybe as a club, you know, I think we have to learn to respect this competition. I think maybe being in the Europa League has kind of slightly skewed or diminished our view of European football. But I think, you know, this Champions League campaign has taught us if you drop below your level, you will suffer. Look at what happened to us against Lens, right? Look how we struggled in against PSV, was it, when we rotated? Similarly, you know, Porto, that was a draw we sort of actively wanted, and look what hard work it was. Bayern struggling in the Bundesliga, no away fans, perhaps this will be a breeze. Far from it. The calibre of these teams is strong. And I think because of the strength of the Premier League, you know, I think maybe sometimes we overlook that. And the Europa League is a very, very, very different competition.
Yeah, for sure.
And I know we all sort of know that, but I do think
nice to get a reminder
about the level, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, I don't... Anyone who thought it was going to be a breeze against Bayern Munich was getting carried away with themselves. You know, no two ways about it.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know that people were saying that.
I know. But, like, there was a confidence going into this. I think sometimes it is useful to get a reality check of both... You know, who you are, where you are, and what you need to do. Like,
how many
Wenger teams with, you know, better teams? Well, yeah, better teams struggled to get to where they should have got to in the Champions League. You know, we had so many seasons where, you know, we went out early or had results where you're going, we've got to learn how to play European football better. And part of that was because, you know, we actually had to learn.
Well, and also, you know, last time we were in the Champions League, we were being battered by teams like this. So as much as I might feel a bit disappointed or aggrieved that we didn't come out the first leg with an advantage, you know, we were in there. We were right in there with Bayern. And this is our first season back in this competition. So I don't think there's any need for despondency or anything like that.
No, no.
Here's a quick question related to that from Louis Leddy, who just said, "Evening, gents. Do you think Arteta will target players who have big Champions League experience in the summer? It seems especially defensively we could do with some more experience at this level in the team."
I mean, I think it would be useful, but I don't think it will be the... like top of the list of the qualities that they're looking for. I think if you can find the, you know, the player that you want, if he has Champions League experience, great. Yeah. If he's still the player you want, he doesn't have it, well, he's going to get it next season.
I mean, your golden goose kind of thing is like, I mean, a little bit what we got in Havertz or theoretically in Timber, a guy who's young but has played a lot of Champions League football.
Yeah.
You know, and they're out there. They are out there. But like you, I think his focus will be more on acclimatizing his current players to the competition than sort of augmenting them with experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And just going back to the point that you made previously, I thought this was a good question. I think we've kind of answered it from 1.76 acres, who said, "More than anything, wasn't yesterday an indication of not the same old Arsenal, but rather our newfound maturity? Two goals shipped needlessly, but instead of a catastrophic result, we actually played well against a very good team and scored a late goal to salvage your result. Shouldn't we all be encouraged by this and not the opposite?" And I do think, you know, in the cold light of day, there is a lot to be encouraged about by the fact that we didn't crumble and didn't go into our shells and didn't, even if we didn't manage the overall occasion as well as we could have, let it get to us to the point where we lost all semblance of ourselves and what we are as a team. So I do think that is encouraging. I'm gonna do one final one here, and this is for you. It comes from Shatner's Bassoon.
Okay.
Who says, "Good afternoon, gents. Irrespective of what you make of the penalty shout, isn't it remarkable how much quicker and less fussy VAR decisions are in Europe? Can you see any reason why the Premier League can't just ask UEFA what their protocol is and copy it, assuming that scrapping the thing is off the table?"
Yeah, I suppose so, actually. I remarked on it being a quick check, but maybe that's because I'm accustomed to Premier League waiting times and I should be praising them for their efficiency. You do barely notice it in the Champions League. It feels like a much smoother process. Is that the technology? Is it the personnel? I don't actually know. But I am convinced that the answer for officiating and refereeing is to apply the same logic they took with the players in the Premier League, which is pay the money to get the best in the world.
Mm.
I really firmly believe that, you know, and I think that refereeing needs to be made a very attractive job because these guys are in responsible positions in a huge global form of entertainment and compared to the other people on the pitch are earning a pittance. Now, I understand all the reasons why and I'm not in any way arguing for sort of parity, but I think refereeing a high-profile Premier League game should be an incredibly desirable job that is awarded to the best
sure.
of the best.
I don't disagree with that. I also think that the other aspect of that is that a job like that with that kind of remuneration and that kind of those benefits financially also has to come with accountability, that there has to be a sort of a system in which if you do not meet the level, if you fail to meet the standards, then, you know, you pay the price with your job and maybe somebody else gets that job. At the moment, that's not how it works. There's a small pool of referees in an organization that's, you know, just not run in a way that can possibly get the best out of the officials. Not to mention, I think, the Premier League PGMOL referees at this point are genuinely terrified to get anything wrong for all kinds of reasons, because they've got so much wrong in the past and there's been so much focus on it that they spend way too much time making decisions. And I think if, you know, I might not agree with the VAR decision not to give Bukayo Saka a penalty, but do I appreciate the fact that the decision was made pretty quickly and nobody's sitting around going like, what's happening here? We've got no clue. You know, yeah. I prefer that, like VAR, the implementation of it, at least in that way, is far preferable than, particularly in stadium, where you're sitting there for 4 or 5 minutes, you've got no clue what's going on.
Totally. I agree with that. And I think that I have given this sort of a fair bit of thought. And I just think that the Premier League is about an international elite and that should apply to the officials as much as the players. And I think there'd be a secondary benefit, which is that you'd kind of break up the northwest of England cabal. I think you by appointing officials who aren't from this country and aren't necessarily steeped in the culture of it, you would, you know, you eradicate potentially a lot of biases. Or certainly even accusations of bias,
sure,
you know?
I understand.
So I think it would be cleaner in some respects. But
chance would be a fine thing.
Yeah, it won't happen.
It will not happen. Okay, look, we're going to leave it there. James, you're probably jet-lagged and, you know, need to
just
relax.
Yeah, I don't know
relax.
What day it is or what time it is, to be honest.
Relax,
man,
get some sleep, try and get your body clock back on UK time. So we'll leave it there. To you guys, thank you as always for being with us. Really appreciate you listening, downloading. Thanks as well for all the reviews last week. That was very kind and generous of you. We really appreciate that. For now, take it easy and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.